Morning.
What I'd like to do today is to continue our discussion about projection methods and talk about linear discriminant analysis. We'll begin by talking about this for a simple two-class problem, and then we will generalize this to a multi-class problem. There's some nice resources here that go into this technique in more detail, and linear discriminant analysis is very widely used these days. So, good topic. So last time we talked about whitening transformations and linear transformations and how we can use principal components analysis. And what did we conclude about the behavior of principal components analysis? How did we explain its features or its operation? I mean, aside from we state there that it models a Dana least square sense, so what was the implication of that? Close. When we talk about class-independent principal components analysis, we certainly take all the data together and we model it as a Gaussian. We compute the covariance. And then what do we do with respect to that covariance? That covariance is, in general, the support region for that multi-dimensional Gaussian is an elliptical type shape in two dimensions at least. And what did we say then principal components analysis does? So when you have this ellipse, how is it going to model that the data represented by that elliptical support region? Right. And what does the major axis represent? The variance, right? It goes after the first dimension, essentially, goes after the direction of greatest variance. The second dimension goes after the next largest dimension perpendicular to that. So in the case of an ellipse, this has a nice interpretation that the first direction is along the major axis, the second direction is along the minor axis. Now, why does that make sense? Why is that useful to us? If, for example, as we talked about last class, you're trying to sell cars. I mean, this makes sense. Today I'm going to say nothing but bad things about PCA, but before I do that, I want to make sure we understand what PCA does. It makes sense. Particularly when you're trying to understand data. Why? Why does modeling the data by looking at the directions of greatest variance, why does that make sense? Why, if you were selling cars, as we talked about last time, why would you be interested in the direction of greatest variance? I think you're right, but you started dancing around the simple explanation. In what sense? Let me ask this another way with maybe a different example, since we're sort of at the tail end of what was an election process. If you were a presidential candidate trying to optimize your resources and you wanted to, and you looked at all the people, the demographics of the people supporting you and the people voting against you, and they do this, in fact, why would you be interested at first with the direction of maximum variance? Well, but what does that represent in terms of the your ability to get elected? What does that tell you about your base of support within the voters? You're all right. It's just we haven't quite. I'm just looking for a little bit more. Not the effect of fewest people. The direction of greatest variance is going to explain most of the variance of your data set. So what's that going to tell you if you're a politician and you're trying to understand who's supporting you? It's going to tell you the characteristics of your largest, single largest group of support. If you're a car salesman, it's going to tell you what features or what considerations are most important to your customers. So, you know, if, for example, if you pooled all the voters for the last election and you looked at the people who supported Obama and you pooled them, Republicans and Democrats, and you asked the question, what is the... And party affiliation, age, all these things were important. And you did principal components analysis. What would be the first thing that would pop out? Well, the first thing that would pop out would be that Democrats are supporting you because he was a Democratic candidate. And then other things that would pop out as some of the higher dimensions would be things like income level, educational level, you know, all these things, because he had a lot of support amongst well-educated people, amongst working-class people, you know, et cetera. You can pull this. This is what principal components analysis does. It's very closely related to something called factor analysis, and there are a couple different ways statisticians do this, but the bottom line is it makes sense what PCA is doing. It's trying to model the data. It's a representative technique. It's trying to understand variance in the data. Class-independent PCA. And many of you, well, you know, 10, 20 years ago, you saw a lot of people using this technique for pattern recognition. Now, what doesn't PCA do? In the process of modeling variance of the data, what doesn't PCA do? Okay, so let's go back to the election example, since that's a nice two-class problem. So you now understand when you pool all the voters together, you understand that you've got good support amongst Democrats, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what doesn't PCA tell you that would be really that is very important to you if you're a candidate running for office, like the presidency? Okay, so now it's getting close to the election, and the election's close, and you're trying to decide how to expend your resources. In fact, if you followed the election last year, the candidates were very savvy about how they spent their time in the last few weeks of the election. So one of the first things that you want to know if you're a candidate, you want to look at the difference between the voters supporting you and the voters not supporting you. That's a discrimination problem. You want to understand key differences between the group that supports you and the group that doesn't support you. And what are the most important dimensions in those differences? So we're going to talk about a technique today, linear discriminant analysis, that helps you understand that, because it's going to look at differences between the classes, not grouping the classes all together in one big pot. So we're going to talk about multiple discriminant analysis, and this is a projection that best separates the data in a least square sense. And then we'll look at later independent component analysis, which is, as we talked about last time, based on information theory principles. So let's first introduce the general concept of discriminant analysis. Discriminant analysis seeks directions that are efficient for discrimination. And by discrimination, we mean your ability to assign data correctly to one or the other class. So consider the problem of projecting data from D dimensions. So we have a feature vector, which is D dimensions, onto a line with the hope that we can optimize the orientation of the line to minimize error. So linear discriminant analysis, it's a projection operation. We're ultimately going to try to project the data onto a line that is pointing in the direction of maximum discrimination between the two classes. And we'll show you today how to do that. So consider a set of n d-dimensional samples, x1 through xn. These are vectors. And there's a subset d1, which belongs to class omega-1, and a subset d2, which belongs to class omega-2. Let's define a linear combination of x. Y is equal to some weight vector w transpose times x. And a corresponding set of n samples, y1 through yn. And those will be divided into groups y1 and y2. So the data associated with class omega-1 is transformed and forms class y1. It's still class omega-1, but the vectors are now transform vectors, and that's still set y1. And then we have a similar thing for set y2. Our challenge... So what are the free variables that we have at our disposal to do this discrimination? Well, we still want to do something like threshold decoding. Set a threshold, and if data falls to the left of that, it's in class 1. If it falls to the right, it's in class 2, that kind of a thing. The only free variables that we have at our disposal is this weight vector w. And again, what I like about this is it really shows you how simple the pattern recognition problem is. Just find the values of w. There's D values of W. That's all you have to find. And you can do pattern recognition. So our challenge is to find W that maximizes the separation. This can be done by considering the ratio of between class scatter to the within class scatter. That's essentially one of the ways all of these discriminant techniques work, and we'll see in a moment that that's based on the notion of Fisher's discriminant ratio. So we'll define a sample mean for class I. M sub I, the vector, is the mean, which is just 1 over the number of elements in the I's class, n sub I, times the sum of the x's through that belong to class D sub I. The sample mean for the projected points we'll call M sub I tilde. Well, that's just the average of the vectors Y that are associated with the I's class, which are just the transformed vectors. So we can write this as W transform times X, where the X's are also the vectors that are associated with the I's class. And we can write that since W is a constant with respect to the sum. This is nothing more than W transpose times M sub I. So this is kind of nice because it shows you that the transformed mean, well, it shows you that the mean of the I's class in the transformed space is just the transformed mean. And that's another example of why means are so useful to us. They're linear operations, and therefore they behave properly when you talk about things like linear transformation. So the sample mean for the projected points is just the projection of the mean, which is expected since this is a linear transform. It follows that the distance between the projected means, which for a two-class case is going to be M1 tilde minus M2 tilde, that difference is going to be W transpose M1 minus W transpose M2. But you'll recall now we're trying to project the data onto a line. So these are actually scalars, and these are vectors. And that doing that will allow us then to use simple threshold decoding on those projected means. So define a scatter for the projected samples. This is going to be the We're going to call that S sub I tilde squared. It's going to be a variance. And that's going to be the sum of the projected y's minus the projected mean squared summed over the i's class. Y is a member of y sub I. And an estimate of the variance of the pooled data is just essentially the sum of these two. In a two-class case, it's just the sum of these two scatters. So scatter is related to the variance. This is the scatter of the i-th class, and this is the scatter of the total two classes in this case. And therefore, this is called the within-class scatter because it's the sum of the scatters of each of the classes. So it's sort of a measure of how compact your data is with respect to the means of those classes. The Fisher linear discriminant, and this is a well-known concept in statistics, maximizes the criteria J of W is going to be the independent variable, J of W is equal to, and we're going to look at this initially just for the two-class case, the norm of M1 minus M2 squared divided by this pooled or the within-class scatter, S1 tilde squared plus S2 tilde squared. So we can define a scatter for class S sub I as the sum of each of the vectors x minus m sub I times x minus m sub I transpose. The only difference between these two is that this boldface s sub I is done on the data in its original space. These s tildes are the data done in the transform space. Now, if this is a linear transformation, what can be said about the relationship between distances measured in the original data space and distances measured in the transform space? Can we be a little more precise about that? So Simrall is close to the library. Simrall is far away from the post office. I apply some kind of linear transformation to this world that we live in here. What would I expect in that transform world? Now, the transformation could actually include a rotation and a translation. So in the transform space, I could be somewhere. But what's going to be true? The distances, the relationships to the distances should be the same. So the projection of Simrall and the projection of the library should still be close in this transform space, and the projection of the post office should be far away. So these linear transforms preserve, they're distance preserving, people often say. So these scatters we would expect to behave in a similar way because they're really just the accumulation of norms or square distances. Now, the total scatter, S sub W, is S1 plus S2. And that's, again, measured in the original space. We can write the scatter for the projected samples in terms of W's and X's. We can write that S sub I tilde squared, is the sum of, now summing over x's, all the x's associated with the i-th class, we can write that as omega w transpose times x minus w transpose times m sub I, and that quantity squared. We can expand this as w transpose times x minus m sub I, x minus m sub I transpose times w, just noting that this is a quadratic, and our usual breaking that out into A transpose B times B transpose A. And that in turn can be written as W transpose times S sub I times W. Now, why is that interesting to us? Remember, W is the independent variable. We're going to adjust W to achieve some separation of the classes. So why is this equation of interest to us? That should look familiar by now. So where are we headed with this? When you see equations like that, what words pop in your mind? We'll play word association this morning. What? Okay. Not quite, that's true. What other words? Covariance, that's true. Other words. Eigenvector, thank you, right? When you see these kinds of things, because, in fact, covariances we know can be factored into eigenvectors and eigenvalues, and we know that quadratics generally result in these kinds of, when you optimize a quadratic, when you differentiate it, you get a linear. And so when you take the constraint of a quadratic and your optimization equation is a linear, it always seems like it turns out that eigenvalues are the solution. That's not uncommon. So those are all good points. But the key thing here is we see, okay, the solution to this problem is going to have something to do with eigenvalues. And secondly, you see the influence the weight vector has on the scatter, and the two are decoupled in a sense, so that's a good thing because we're going to want to adjust W to maximize the separation between the classes, the I classes. So the sum of the scatters can be written as, well, if we just sum these up now, we're going to have the sum of this for S1, S2, S3, and that in turn can be collapsed into W transpose times S sub W times W, where S sub W is essentially the sum of the individual scatters. Again, because we're dealing with linear transformations, these kinds of results are not surprising, that we can collapse sums into single equations and things like that. So the separation of the projected mean obeys the following equation. We have M1 tilde minus M2 tilde is just going to be this W transpose times M1 minus W transpose times M2, that quantity squared. We can write that as W transpose M1 minus M2 times M1 minus M2 transpose times W. And we're going to write that as W transpose times S sub B times W, where B is the between class scatter, and B is given by M1 minus M2 quantity multiplied by M1 minus M2 transpose. So this is looking interesting to us because we have the distance between the means as a function of the means, and then we have the total scatter as well. So SW is the within-class scatter and is proportional to the covariance of the pooled data. SB is the between-class scatter, and this is symmetric and positive definite because it's this quadratic. But because it is the outer product of two vectors, its rank is at most 1. So this implies that for any W, S sub B times W is in the direction of M1 minus M2. And we can now write the criterion function J of W as W transpose times S sub B times W divided by W transpose times S sub W times W. And this is what we were after because now we have a criterion function in terms of the between class scatter divided by the within class scatter. So if we wanted to choose the values of W in a principled way, what would make sense if this is our objective function? if your goal is to discriminate, and you have the ratio of the between-class scatter to the within-class scatter, and this within-class scatter is the sum of the individual scatters for each class. That's S1 squared plus S2 squared. What does it make? And your only free variable is W. How do you want to adjust W? Excuse me. What would be your... what would be your approach? So we've got the between class scatter in the numerator. What does that tell you about the two classes? If that is large, what does that imply about the two classes? They're far apart, right? And if that is small, they're close. So we certainly would like to adjust W to maximize the numerator. And then what about the denominator? That's the within class scatter. If you're going to get good performance of your classifier, what do you want to be true of the within-class scatter? Minimize, right. You want those regions to be nice and compact and centered about and focused around the mean. So we want to maximize the numerator and minimize the denominator. So this ratio is well known as the generalized Rayleigh quotient and has the property that the vector W that maximizes J must satisfy the equation that S sub B times W is equal to lambda times S sub W times W. This is just can be shown, can be proven, but we'll skip the details of that since we sort of know where this is headed in terms of eigenvalues and eigenvectors. So that tells us then that if this is true, that W is going to be SW inverse times M1 minus M2. And this is known as Fisher's linear discriminant, and it's also known as the canonical variance. So this value of W essentially maximizes the numerator and minimizes the denominator of that previous expression that we showed. And this solution maps the d-dimensional problem to a one-dimensional problem. Now, from chapter 2, when the conditional densities P of X given omega sub I are multivariate normal with equal covariances, the optimal decision boundary, we learned, is given by W transpose times X plus a constant W0, or an offset, is equal to 0. And that's why we talked about we showed how we could map this problem of choosing the distance or finding the midpoint between two Gaussians and setting a threshold. We showed how we could map that essentially to this dot product operation with an offset. And we showed that the W in this case was psi inverse times mu1 minus mu2, and W0 is related to the prior probabilities. So this is essentially the linear discriminant analysis solution to the two-class problem. You compute the means, you compute the within-class scatter, and you can find W in that way. The computational complexity is dominated by calculation of the within-class scatter and its inverse, and that requires O of D squared N calculations, where D is a dimension and N is the number of data points. But the good thing about that is this is collected. S sub W can be estimated offline. It's not done at runtime during classification. During classification, we just have, once again, our simple threshold decoding, so we just have to do a dot product and then a comparison. So let's look at how this works in practice. So we talked last time, we went through an example like this. Using principal components analysis. And we said that what it's going to do is to compute a single covariance combining both classes, and then it's going to model that as a Gaussian, and then it'll draw a decision surface that's essentially perpendicular to the line connecting the two means. So we get something like that. Now, when you look at this data, what do you observe about the direction of variance within the classes? It's horizontal. The direction of discrimination, you could either say is vertical or is diagonal, but it's in a different direction than the direction of variation of each class, than the direction of greatest variance of each class. Now, when you pool the classes together, obviously the direction of variance becomes this direction, diagonal, because you're pooling the data together. But with linear discriminant analysis now, we're going to compute the means of these classes, and then we're going to compute this projection operation to separate the distance between these two classes. So let's see how that works. So the first thing we do is we compute the means of each one of the classes, and those are here. We compute the covariance. We compute the transformation matrix as that's the inverse of this covariance matrix times the difference between these two means. And then we do classification, and we get essentially the same result as PCA for this case, because the classes are separable. Now, let's see if we can create an example where there's some degree of difference between the two solutions. So what I'm going to do first, is draw a set that way. And now what I'm going to do is to draw a set vertically that intersects with this data. I think this is going to work. I haven't tried this in a while. Let me do that again. So we're going to draw a class here . Now we're going to take a second class and draw that here. So PCA is going to find the two means. So the mean of this first class is located somewhere here. And the mean of the second class is located somewhere here. So when you have these kinds of overlaps, one of the problems you run into is that the means are being masked by the variance, you could say. And we'll show that in a second with principal components analysis. But let's see what should be the optimal decision surface for this data? What line can I draw that will minimize the overall error rate, classification error rate? That's a little tough, right? But you might think of a line perpendicular to the two means, which is going to throw But the tomb, the one mean is here, the other mean is here. So you could have a line somewhere in here, which is certainly going to classify this data correctly, and it's going to give you an error. All this data will be an error. And then it'll also classify this data correctly. And it essentially does that. It takes a line between the two means. The one mean is here, one mean is here, and essentially tries to project the data onto that line and then set a threshold along that line. And and there's the line isn't quite perfectly perpendicular because, remember, it's fitting these classes with Gaussians. So let's see what PCA does for this class. Let me clear the output. So PCA fits the data with a Gaussian, and you can see what's happened with that Gaussian is it sort of looked at the direction of greatest variance, which in this case happens to be this direction because this class is so big and it's sort of dominating the calculation. But it's not really doing a good job of explaining variance in this direction. And it comes up with that classification. Now let's see what the error, I should have noted what the error rate is. So the classification error rate for that line is 34%. So let's see if LDA, in fact, gives us a lower classification error with the line that it drew here. Do I still have that in the window? I think I might, actually, right? Yeah, so LDA gave us 33.4%, a minor improvement. Not striking, but, you know, some improvement. And let's see, just for kicks, what happens if we do class-dependent PCA? Yeah. That's interesting. Actually, so let's see what that is, 11%. So class-dependent PCA is, this class-dependent properties are powerful because you're now allowed to have covariances explaining each one of the classes independently. And there we can actually do a class-independent LDA as well. So class-dependent PCA gave us an 11% error rate. Let's see what happens if we do class-dependent PCA. I won't talk about that today, but we'll talk about multi-class LDA in a moment. Yeah, so class-dependent LDA gives us not a very good error rate. So they do class-independent. Oh, okay, good. Yeah, let's clear the output. . 33%. So that's interesting, actually. I've not run this set of examples before. Class-dependent PCA actually works very well. You don't see that described in a lot of textbooks, but it's a good algorithm. But you see that for the class-independent case, LDA does slightly better than PCA. So you can play around with that. There are a couple other. Let's try one more example. Let's create. let's try something like this. So we have overlapping classes. So PCA gives us 31.2%. I don't think LDA in this case is going to give us much difference. So LDA gave us 31%. So a slight reduction in error rate, but not much with LDA. So you can run some examples after offline and try to get better appreciation for when the solutions between these two differ. Now, we can generalize the LDA solution for the C-class problem where C is greater than 2 in a D-dimensional space. The natural generalization involves C minus 1 discriminant function. So the within-class scatter is going to be defined by the sum over the C-classes of S sub I, and that's going to be the sum over C-classes of X minus M sub I times X minus M sub I transpose. We can define a total mean vector M, which is a weighted sum of the means of the individual classes. And we can then define a total scatter matrix as the sum over of the X's minus this total mean vector. The total scatter is related to the within class scatter by the following equations. We can show that the total scatter is equal to the within-class scatter plus the between-class scatter. And the between-class scatter in this multi-class case is just going to be the weighted sum of eb sub I minus m times eb sub I minus m transpose. So m is this global mean, but it's reflective of all the data, so it's weighted. It's a weighted sum of the means based on the number of samples in each class. And similarly, the between class scatter is also weighted by the number of elements within each class, and it's measured with respect to the global mean. So clearly, if we try to maximize this in the transform space, we're going to separate the distances between the classes, and then if we try to minimize this term, we're going to keep things compact. So we have C minus 1 discriminant function of the form Y is equal to W sub I transpose times X, where I goes from 1 to C minus 1. So in the case of two classes, we get one discriminant function. In the case of three classes, we get two discriminant functions. Yeah. Yeah, that's just to make sure that you're weighting the contributions of these with. So this actually, if M sub I's are the means of the individual classes, this will actually give you the global mean. But we write it this way to make you understand it's also the weighted sum of the individual means. You can also get that M just by adding up all the data, because that's why we're essentially multiplying by the number of data points within each class. No, because I don't think for SW we did either. Excuse me. So, and since we're going to take the ratio of those, it'll normalize out anyway. So we have these C minus 1 discriminant functions, and the criterion function is now going to be J of W, where W is now a matrix, W transpose times S sub B times W, divided by W transpose times S sub W of W, and then we'll take the norm of that. So we have a similar formulation in terms of the between-class scatter and the within-class scatter, but now we have this matrix W because we have C minus 1 discriminant function. So the matrix W has a rank which is sort of one less than C. The solution to maximizing this function is once again found via an eigenvalue decomposition. You can show that you can write S sub B minus lambda sub I times W is equal to zero. The lambdas that solve this equation give you the W's that maximize that equation. And that in turn can be written as S sub B minus lambda sub I times S sub W times the vector W is equal to zero. And because S sub B is the sum of C rank one or less matrices, and because only C minus 1 of these are independent, S sub B is ranked C minus 1 or less. So, in a nutshell, what we're doing here is we're essentially, similar to PCA, you're going to find the first discriminant function by looking at the maximum eigenvalue. And you're going to find the next discriminant function by looking at the second largest eigenvalue and looking at the eigenvector corresponding to that. And then you'll work your way down, but you only have to do the first C minus 1 of these because the last one is not necessary because we're projecting onto a line in a general sense, so we're projecting down one dimension. So if we were working this as a two-class problem, you'd only have to worry about the maximum eigenvalue. But in the process of doing that, we're choosing the eigenvalues to maximize the separation between the ratio of the between class and the within class. So this is a generalization of LDA to the multi-class problem. And I've got a link here to a presentation of one of our master students who worked on this many years ago. You can look at that if you want to see some more details of how this works. So what we did today is we introduced the notion of component analysis, and we defined a criterion that maximizes discrimination versus maximizing what we often say representation or a generative model. So this is one of our first discriminative models that we've introduced in this class. PCA is one of our first generative models. We showed the solution to the two-class problem, and then we generalized this to C classes, and we did a little bit of comparison of LDA and PCA. So what we're going to do next is to look at some generalizations of LDA and investigate if we can relax some of the assumptions made with LDA. So in PCA, we made this assumption about grouping the data together and modeling variance. With LDA, we made this assumption that we want to project the data onto a line. And next we'll look at some, we'll further relax those assumptions. We'll still stick with the notion of a linear transformation, but we'll derive something which is a little bit more general than LDA. And we'll compare those solutions. Okay, so I will see you on Monday.